following episode of Handy Link is an encore presentation because of the ongoing COVID-19 situation. To my audience members, I'm hoping you're staying healthy, happy, and safe. After the situation has passed, I look forward to bringing you some fresh episodes detailing how different disability groups responded during these uncertain times. My thoughts are with you. Stay safe.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Dr. Umeth Sushdev.
We are hosting a symposium on November 2nd at Michigan State University, and we're going to be bringing together a really respected cast of speakers. Myself, as the Director of Neuromuscular Medicine at Michigan State, Dr. Amro Sino, a esteemed colleague of mine at the University of Michigan, Megan Reed, who is a specialist in neuromuscular disorders from our physical therapy partners here in the Lansing area, the Recovery Project, and some additional faculty being brought to us from CSL Behring with an expertise in the pharmaceutical treatment of CIDP. I'm really excited to bring this group together, and this is going to be oriented towards patients and educating them about their disease and what's coming.
So, for those who might not be as familiar with the disease, can you tell me a little about it?
So, chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy is a mouthful. It is a disease where there is inflammation that is targeted against the nerves of the arm and the leg. And first, it starts to damage the nerves that help you feel. Then it starts to damage the nerves that help you move. And so patients with this disease will quickly and relentlessly lose sensation and movement. And if it's not identified and managed, those changes will be permanent.
So can you tell me a little bit about the identification process?
So it starts with a physical exam. It's always, in neurology, we pay a lot of attention to the history that the patient is telling us and the physical features. So noticing that patients have weakness of the hands or feet, that's occurring symmetrically, both sides are affected. Noticing that things like reflexes are no longer present. Or something called proprioception, the ability to tell where your limb is without looking at it. And then once we've identified those sorts of features on a physical exam and a patient who's telling us that they're getting worse at a rapid pace, then we will use additional testing. We may need to stick a needle in the low back and draw off fluid. That's called a lumbar puncture. And we may need to stimulate the nerve. That is a test called an EMG. And those are the major elements of how we figure out in CIDP.
So when it comes to the symposium, Has this been done before? And if so...
At Michigan State University, no, it has not. This is the first one that we've done for CIDP patients. As the GBS Foundation, a strong partner of ours, does host 4 of these events a year. And they have been gracious enough to help us advertise our event with their membership, the GBS CIDP Foundation out of Pennsylvania.
So, have there been any challenges in putting together the symposium thus far?
Well, we have a really strong neuromuscular community in the state of Michigan. And I must say that our population is blessed in that regard. And so we have some really excellent faculty. Putting this together, I had thought that finding speakers might be a challenge. That was not the case at all. And then this is a rare disease, so just reaching out to people who have it, I anticipated was going to be a challenge. And in fact, through a combination of partners and lists, we were able to put together direct mail to 790 patients and individuals associated with treatment of the disease. And so I've just been blown away by the community and the response.
So you say it's a rare condition. Do you know about how many people would be affected by this?
So the condition affects about 1.5 people for every 100,000. And so to put those numbers into something you can get a handle on, in the state of Michigan, we have approximately 10 million people. And so that would mean that every year, approximately 150 people have developed the disease. The disease is not necessarily fatal. So about 10 out of every 100,000 people have it. That means that in the state of Michigan, we have about 1,000 people with the disorder.
So you could send any message to the community about the need for this symposium and continued work on this disease, what would you say?
I would say that while it's important to learn about your disease and perhaps we can put in front of you people who can help you understand it a little bit better or give you tips about how to cope with the disease, how to recover, it's far more important that what we're doing is we're bringing together patients and families. And it's easy to get lonely when you have a disease that no one has ever heard of, and maybe your family doctors only have one patient in their practice. Community is so important to recovery. If there's a reason to attend an event like this, either mine or something that the GBS CIDP Foundation puts together, it's community.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Eveline Honig, who'll be telling us a little bit about narcolepsy. So tell me a little bit about narcolepsy and the work of your organization in regards to it.
So narcolepsy is a serious neurological sleep disorder, and we are a national patient support organization. We do everything from helping individual people to several large programs. One of our programs is, as I just mentioned, our annual conference. And this is coming up in New Mexico next week, and we have that in a different part of the country. It's a weekend-long conference. It's mostly for people with narcolepsy, their family members and friends, but also for professionals. So we have all kinds of things there, from presentations, from the latest research, medications, as well as... We have ways to cope with narcolepsy, such as exercises, nutrition, for family members to cope. We have sessions, legal sessions, what your rights are, and in school and at work. So anyway, that's a huge conference. We're also starting with one-day meetings. It's like that's a mini version of our annual conference. Then we do advocate. We go to Washington, D.C. in Rare Disease Week, and we advocate for people with narcolepsy. We go to our constituents. So that's another thing we do. We have a very nice few years old youth ambassador program. This is for kids age 15 to 22. We train them, and then they go out in their communities to talk about narcolepsy and to raise awareness.
So
then we have a lot of other things. We do some fundraising. We've had walks. We also, you know, I travel a lot to international meetings. I have just, you know, helped with an article. Another thing we do is we run as a charity in the New York City Marathon, and we raise quite a bit of money and awareness that way. So that's basically, as I said, we go to symposiums, meetings. We have exhibit spaces there, so we raise awareness also on what we do for physicians in the sleep world. And we've been going to meetings such as for school nurses, school guidance counselors, pediatricians, even school principals, all kinds of ways to raise awareness.
So what are some of the major challenges facing someone with narcolepsy?
I'm sorry, the noise has gotten, I don't know if you can hear it, but
A little. So
it's just pretty bad here.
So what are some of the major challenges facing someone with... Tell me a little bit about some of the challenges a person with narcolepsy might face.
They face a lot of discrimination. And it's because they fall asleep. They can't help it. They fall asleep oftentimes everywhere, sometimes in embarrassing situations like in school, at weddings. Sometimes even in at a funeral, so people think that they should be able to control it because they're so very, very sleepy. They're also being told oftentimes that they're lazy, and it's uncontrollable sleepiness. They have something else called cataplexy, which happens. You know, they fall down, they lose muscle control. That can be very embarrassing, too. That happens very often when they get emotional, so either happy or angry about something. So that can happen in a lot of very embarrassing situations.
So.
And if they're not well managed with medications, and oftentimes that still happens, then this is a very difficult situation. So the most devastating thing is the discrimination and the lack of understanding by the outside world, and oftentimes their families as well.
So how do we as a society get beyond some of those stigmas and barriers?
How we can get beyond that as a society?
Yes.
I think people need to know what it is, and I think that's basically the main problem. There is no understanding. There's a lack of understanding what it really is. Even in amongst physicians, I'm a physician. I never really knew much about it. You get one paragraph in your neurology course and that's it. So people really don't understand that it's devastating. It's not just sleepiness during the day. It's not being able to sleep at night, and it's a lot of those kinds of things that are happening.
So
So I think we just need to raise awareness. People need to be, and that's what we try to do, if you know, in schools, at in the workplace, and in the general community. But that's a lot of work, and that's still, we need to go a long way still.
So has there been any success moment in your work to raise awareness that stands out for you?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
So, in your work to raise awareness, have there been any successes?
Success stories?
Yes.
Well, we have been going to school nurses, and they were very, very shocked often to hear what it really is. And a lot of them said, now I'm going back to my school, to my kids. Now I know what this is all about. So I think that is really, that was a success story. And we just, generally speaking, when we run the marathon, we have our T-shirts on. People come over to us and ask, what is this? And we explain it to them. We give them our brochures. And then people say, oh, I never knew this. Because I think in the general community, people know now what narcolepsy is, but they just think, oh, it's when people fall asleep like that, just like that, right? But they don't really know what it really is. And if they read a little bit or hear a little bit, then they will understand more.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Windsor's premier chamber choir, Windsor Classic Chorale, presents Eve of Remembrance, featuring Brahms' Requiem, Sunday, November 10th at Paulin Memorial Presbyterian Church in Windsor, starting at 3 p.m. Tickets are $20 and are available online at windsorclassiccorale.org. Honor Remembrance Day by reflecting on the sacrifices of Canada's armed forces with a solemn afternoon of choral music on Sunday, November 10th. Proudly supported by CJAM 99.1 FM.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Dr. Umeth Sushdev and from Dr. Eveline Honig about narcolepsy. In this next segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Scott Saylor, who'll be telling us a little bit about galactosemia. So tell me a little bit about galactosemia.
Galactosemia is a rare genetic disease that basically affects about 1 in 60,000 births. It's a genetic defect from both parents that causes a metabolism issue, an inborn error of metabolism, which basically the body of a galactosemic baby does not possess the enzymes to be able to break down milk sugar. The milk sugar builds up in the system and can become toxic to organs, usually affecting the liver immediately, and also affecting the eyes, the female reproductive system, along with some other common side effects.
So, do you know offhand about how many people are affected by this?
We do not have a complete list across the country. However, we would be looking at about 400 to 500 births per year across the United States. And if you extrapolate that out, You know, you're talking about tens of thousands of individuals affected by this. The biggest barrier we have to keeping a complete list of those affected is there are varying side effects. Some babies are affected very severely with different side effects like apraxia, things like that, and they stay involved in the community. Others do very well and thrive, and they kind of fall out of the community. The other thing that has really changed in the past 20 years is in 2002 was the first year that every state in the United States tested for galactosemia during newborn testing. Prior to 2002, if the state did not test, many of these babies died at birth, or shortly, I should say, shortly after birth of liver failure.
So can you tell me about some of the supports that your organization offers in terms of those affected?
Sure. So the Galactosemia Foundation was founded by parents of galactosemic children. It's always been a advocate group to increase education, to get education to new families who have a child that's been diagnosed with galactosemia. We've also worked to build our medical professional network to get more interest in researching this disease. We have a biannual conference. We rotate that throughout the country to make it accessible to different families across the country. At that biannual conference, we have medical professionals who provide research updates, who provide their insight into how to manage the galactosemic diet. And we also, you know, advocate and try to change policy in the government. So different things like baby formula that is specialized formula, hypoallergenic formula, is covered by insurances and different things like that.
So in your time with the foundation, what's been the greatest success that you've seen?
I think there's several. We have a lot of groups throughout the country, families that fundraise. That fundraising has been increasing year over year over the past 12 years of my involvement with the group. We've been able to fund research grants to several different university research hospitals across the country, including Boston University, Boston, which is in partnership with Boston Children's Hospital, University of Utah, Emory University down in Atlanta. We've been able to increase those research grants every year over the past 12 years. We are a all-volunteer organization. We have no paid employees. We have very little overhead, so every dollar we raise spent toward education and research, which is something I'm very, very proud of as an organization. Really, our only expenses are some office expenses, and we've been able to expand that researcher network. The last grant cycle in 2015 grant cycle, we had 8 submissions requesting funding, and our most recent one we had 16. So we doubled the number of grant applications, and we had some new interest from the research university circle, including Duke University, among others, who are now more interested in researching a possible cure or better treatment.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely.
Found today's show most interesting in a look at narcolepsy. It's one of those everyone knows it, but nobody understands it sort of things. In so much as we all know that it exists and it's a household name condition. However, understanding its real impact is something else. It's not something a person can control. They're not just tired because they stayed out too late one night. I mean, we all have one of those once in a while. That's understandable. This is a serious medical condition. It's something we must take note of as employers, colleagues, educators, whatever walk of life we may be in. Let's recognize it for what it is. Something that impacts a person's ability. It impacts their whole lives, really. And blaming them, saying you're lazy, or saying that you should get more sleep, isn't going to fix the problem. All it's going to do is lead a person to feel bad about something they just can't control. And it's not our place as a society to cast that ray of judgment on anyone. Truth is, these are people who live and work, have families, what have you. And however they're able to contribute to society, they are still contributing. And it's up to each of us to recognize that no matter what a person's circumstances are, they do have something valuable to say. If you're someone with a story of disability life, write HandyLink 4, HandyLink, and the numeral 4, at gmail.com. Always love to hear your stories, folks. Also, the symposium that Dr. Sakdev mentioned really is a great idea, in so much as with any rare condition, it can be hard to think of society as something that understands, especially if you're the only one in a given area. You start to feel that isolation, that no one understands me feeling. And that's the kind of thing that is a myth that simply must be challenged, my friends. It's something we must ensure people understand. They are not alone. They don't have to face it alone. And community does breed strength. And from the instant someone with a rare condition meet someone like them, there's usually that instant connection, that realization that their world is so much bigger than they give it credit for. And there are so many more connections, so much more understanding out there. The people don't have to go through it alone. Isolation breeds depression. And truly, the world's depressed enough, in my opinion. For the fact is, the more we reach out to a person with a disability, even if it's hard, we will eventually get through. We will eventually show them their own strength, show them that their lives have meaning. At first, yeah, it's a trial and error. A lot of people don't want to face the fact that their circumstances might not be what they once were. Or they might tend to idealize the past. But understanding what something is the first step towards being able to take ownership of it. To say, this is who I am, this is what I am, this is what I can do, this is what I want to do, and someday we'll find a way to make happen. And that is the foundation of strength, my friends. Once a person owns their own strength, it's theirs. They can do things the rest of us would never have expected. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.